Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody, coast to coast, This Week in America. It was never an author Joe Gilliland's plan to become a teacher. Certainly not a college teacher, most certainly not an English teacher. But that's what happened, and he's never looked back. In his memoir, A Teacher's Tale, he explains how by neither planning for nor seeking a life of learning and teaching, lacking a syllabus or lesson plan, he discovered that a life in academe lay in his path, a path he's followed for over 50 years. A Teacher's Tale begins in 1932 with Joe's first experience in schooling and concludes in the summer of 1955, just as he completes his apprenticeship and stands on the brink of becoming a qualified instructor in a small college in East Texas. This memoir presents a collection of stories about his experiences as a teacher and a college student. After a story of schooling deeply immersed in the arts and humanities, A Teacher's Tale shares Joe's love of the university, how it compelled him to seek a life devoted to teaching, primarily in the community college area. Through this narrative, he brings together a philosophy of higher education based on the importance of arts and humanities in today's high-tech world. An engrossing and wonderful read, one reviewer saying it's like making a new friend. A Teacher's Tale by Joe Gilliland, and he's our guest on This Week in America. Joe, welcome to the program. A pleasure to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
What an amazing story, and it is like making a new friend. You read the book, and you suddenly feel like you know Joe, and you understand really the importance he's had on the lives of so many students over the course of years. And let's go back to your early years, your foundation. What were your major interests, the most important subjects in elementary school and high school? What were the courses that shaped you?
Well, in elementary school, the only course that only courses that really impacted me immediately were in the third grade. Our school broke out into separate teachers for each subject, unlike a lot of elementary schools today. But the first one that I really enjoyed the most was geography. And it was amazing because everything in it was brand new to me. But the second one that hit me, and the one that was I was to hold on to longest of all, was the reading class. And in that little elementary school in Beaumont, Texas, the reading class was called library. It wasn't called reading because we vetted a classroom with tables, six students at a table, and the walls were lined with books. And we were encouraged to check out books on our own and then to make reports on them. That was after the second grade we had learned to read, but now we were reading books and taking them off the shelves and even learning to put them back. But that geography class with Ms. Hilliard was astounding. We started to begin to study geography by studying the Tigris and Euphrates, Mesopotamia. Can you imagine that?
Yes.
Third grade students learning about Mesopotamia. Well, one of the reasons was that Ms. Hilliard, as a very young woman, had gone with a group of people to Mesopotamia, and she had seen Baghdad, and she'd seen all the great historic sites, but she taught it in terms of geography and the nature of people, and it was amazing. Then the next thing that hit me in the elementary school and carried over into junior high school was science. In our elementary school, they called it a nature class, and it dealt mostly with gardens and bugs and birds, but not really science as we think of it today. And that hit me by way of a Christmas present of a small, what they call the Beginner's Gilbert Chemistry Set for boys. And notice that they said for boys.
For boys, I caught that, yes.
Yeah. And that, of course, that made me feel like I was standing out in some way, because actually I started school when I was five because my mother wanted to get me out of the house. I say today she wanted to get me out of the house. But I started at five, and I was the smallest person in class. And I tell about that in the book, how I had to take a entrance exam for the first grade. But that was simply a readiness, whether I was ready to learn with other students. But those subjects, science and geography and reading, were the framework of what came later for me, my interest and everything were shaped by that.
You know,
and that was then and went on into high school, and in the high school, science became my major interest. And when you read that part about, I didn't expect to become a teacher, much less an English teacher. English was not my most interesting area, but reading was, because in the schools, they seemed to separate reading from English, and they didn't even call it English until the high school. They called it language arts, and there wasn't much art and there wasn't much language in those classes. That were boring as they could be, but the reading part was very important, and that was largely because I had two sisters, older sisters. Dorothy and Jane were absolutely addicted to reading and addicted to books, and they would drag me at a very early age with them to the public library and require me to check out a book. And it didn't really take much to require me to make me check out.
Yes.
I loved to check them out and take them home. But finishing a book sometimes was the thing that my older sister, Dorothy, really demanded. You're not going back with us to the library unless you finish that book. And so that was the stimulus that made me do it.
But
later
on,
I did not really connect reading with school as much as reading for the pleasure of doing it. And that had me hooked. And I separated the idea that reading was absolutely necessary for life. Just the opposite. I considered reading was absolutely necessary for life, but not for getting a job. And everybody in those days was really emphasizing the idea, the importance of
yes.
job and work. Because as you pointed out in the beginning, that was 1932. And you know when that was. That was in the depth of the Depression. I heard the word all the time. Wasn't quite sure what it was. Because when you're 5 years old starting school, the world is just the world directly around you and your sisters and your brother and your family, cousins. And that was the world. And what was going on, I heard about, as people talking about going to the poor farm or being unemployed. And those experiences were the dominant shaping ideas, you know, as you can imagine.
You know, it's just amazing. All of this, by the way, is in Joe's book, A Teacher's Tale, a Memoir. Gilliland is our guest in the program. That's Gilliland. The book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Go to our website. You can link on directly and get all that information. It's amazing as you read and you tell the story, the classes as we know them now had different names back then. I love that. And your sisters, you could share your love of reading with them, but you couldn't share your science kit with them. I mean, it's amazing what you had to go through during that period back then and how things have changed over the decades. Now, you also had an interest in pre-medical studies in college, and you decided not to continue that. You are a doctor with a PhD, but you could have been a medical doctor. Why did you decide not to go down that course?
Well, it was a great disappointment to my mother. She wanted a doctor in the family.
Doctor in the family.
And everybody needs a doctor in the family, she thought, because my father died when I was 5 years old, and she was left a widow in the middle of the Depression. So doctors were very important. And I loved the idea. And in fact, some of the early reading, I read The Citadel, about the A.J. Cronin's story about a young doctor and some of his problems. And I remember the first really serious adult type of American novel I read was Sinclair Lewis's Arrowsmith. And I remember picking that book up, seeing it on the shelf in our junior high school library. And I wonder how that book get on a junior high school library shelf, but it was because the books were probably given to the library. But I opened that cover and I saw that a man named Paul de Kruif, K-R-U-I-F, Paul de Kruif had assisted him, and I had read Microbe Hunters and Men Against Death, books about medicine, about science by Paul, and they were just so wonderfully written. And it said that de Kruif had helped Sinclair Lewis. Well, I had just heard of Sinclair Lewis, but I didn't know too much about him. And man, when I read that book, it really hit me. This is why I want to study science. This is why I want to be a doctor. For crying out loud, this is just a great book. And the idea of reading was so shaping, so important to establishing a points of view and visions of the future and of yourself, actually, that I thought that this is what everybody must do. That had nothing to do with making a living. That had nothing to do with work and a job, which was really impressed upon me because of the economic situation we were in the world. My mother, fortunately, was able to support us by getting jobs, and because we lived with a large nuclear family, so there wasn't any. I was never aware that we were in any financial difficulties, because there was never any. We were never short of anything. We just heard about it from other people. But the idea of pre-med was very important to me. And in high school, I write about it also in the book. I met other students, other friends, other people my age and younger and a little older, who were also independently of the school, very interested in some aspect of science, electricity or botany or geology. And one friend of that I met, was a very young guy, he had actually had a laboratory in his own garage like I did at home. I had my own laboratory. And he actually synthesized things like aniline and azo dyes. And we worked together for a while. Then we created, plus one other young student, Luther Terry was his name, who was very much interested in radio and electricity. And also mathematics. He was a whiz at mathematics. We decided to start a science club. And that was our main interest all the way through science, from the time of I was taking biology right through taking physics. It was just wonderful. And it was just assumed that we were all going to college and we were all going to major in science and that we were all going to be scientists or doctors.
Yes.
Or something of that type, that guided us all the way through. Then on top of that, of course, if you can imagine the dates, 1943 when I graduated was the middle of the war, and we had all been very interested in the war because of the technology that the new war had, the aircraft and all forms of different kinds of, well, radar as a magical sort of invention that you could hardly imagine it could possibly exist, that you can detect airplanes and submarines and sonar and all the technology was just unbelievable. And we knew that the war depended upon good scientists. So whatever we took in college was going to be considered a national requirement. That's when we went into it. And I was one of the few. There's only two people in our science club that did not go on with science. Well, actually, excuse me, Cesar de la Garza, he went through onto psychology. And those early days, well, that's not really science. just mind reading or something like that. But anyway, he took his doctorate in psychology. But I've had a very hard time adjusting to the university life. I was only 16 when I left home, and I walked into the chemistry class, 365 students in a class.
Wow.
And the professor said, I want no one to interrupt me while I'm lecturing. And so what sort of class was that, I thought. But on the other hand, I had an English teacher who talked to us and talked with us and conversed rather than lectured.
Yes.
And we read books, and I said, well, this is going to be easy. You know what? In that English class, I never made I made only one B. Well, it was a B plus, actually. But the rest of my grades were all C's. And Dr. James says, oh, that's not bad. That's good college. In those days, C's were college. The average grade for students were C's.
Yes.
And A's were set aside for people who didn't belong in college. They belonged in graduate school to begin with. But I loved that class because we read novels and wrote about them. And then we read, I have to talk about this. I'm sorry. I get hooked on this. And there was one book that was required reading in addition to our regular theme writing and compositions, H.I. Hayakawa's Language in Action, a study of general semantics. That was a revolution to me, the idea that words could have so many different meanings. And it's very hard to put your finger on actually the correct definition. And we looked at dictionaries only as a compendium of meanings that were going around, not the definitions. There was no such thing. And that sort of idea shook the daylights out of me. And by the time I finished my freshman year, I was 17 years old, and the war was still going on. And that was in June 1940. But I was broke, didn't have any money, couldn't go back to the University of Texas in Austin. And I had to work while I was there, of course. Well, a lot of us did. That's no big deal. But on the other hand, the classes like that English class that really required you to think and not even worry about producing the correct answer, but an answer that might have significance and might help. The chemistry class I did well in, average work really, well at high average B's, and in zoology I did all right. But when I got out, I realized that if I was going to be a doctor, I'd better stop worrying about. I thought at the time, I'd better stop worrying about Ethan Frome or Giants in the Earth or those novels. I better start concentrating strictly on chemistry and physiology and zoology. And that didn't disinterest me as much. So there was one more course that really rocked the boat, almost capsized it for me. It was anthropology. I was one of those students who loved science but was poor in math. And I had math anxiety. Have you heard that before?
Oh, yes, sure. Yes.
And I passed my math, the required algebra course. In those days, freshman algebra was required of all degrees. Unless you took advanced studying, then you could go ahead into calculus if you were made a good enough grade. But by golly, it was that anthropology class that a man named J. Gilbert McAllister, who was a professor, who believed in education by irritation.
And you still remember his name. That's amazing.
All these other courses on the college, they use examination by regurgitation. I'm going to use education by irritation. And if I irritate you enough, you will get so angry, you will begin teaching yourself and you'll argue me down. And he believed that, and the class wasn't terribly large. It was only about 30 students, and he could talk to us. And he said, I'm not going to lecture. I'm going to talk about things, and you're going to answer questions. He gave us stacks of outside reading, things that we had never heard of before, ethnology and the writers like Ruth Benedict and people like that. It was just amazing. So when I finished that freshman year and broke, I couldn't go back to university. I could go home and to Corpus Christi and go to the junior college. They called them junior colleges then. But I got a job and I enlisted in the Army because the Army had a program sending people to college. Navy had one too, called the V-12. But the Army sent me to Texas A&M and to study. And they told us what we were going to study. You're going to be an engineer. And I said, oh my gosh, and all that math. Oh, yeah. Well, lo and behold, the math teacher there knew how to teach math. And I made a B in college trigonometry, a combination, of course, of algebra. I made a B in trigonometry? How did that happen? Well, when I turned 18, this was an Army Specialized Training Reserve program for young men who were 17 years old. We were in the reserve, But when you turned 18, you could, if you were not doing well in the program, they would transfer you immediately to basic training class somewhere. And or if you wanted to, you could transfer yourself. As three of us in that program, we did not want to be engineers. And, you know, by golly, all three of us were readers of books. We were in, ending up reading books in other that were demanded in other courses outside the range of our required reading courses. And we were doing well in the program, but we all volunteered to go into an active unit of some kind. And I remember the Lieutenant Jors, who was the overage in rank reserve officer there at Texas A&M, in charge of our ASTP program. And he said, well, you guys could probably stay here. The war is winding down in Europe, as you know. Well, that was not true, but it looked like it was. And he says, you could stay here probably as long as you wanted to. And then one fellow, a big guy that was really a wonderful student, he said, well, he was afraid that we were going to miss out on the war. He says, and I figured if we finish basic training, we'll be in time for the Japan landings. Now, that was a person 18 years old who didn't know what the world was really about.
Yes.
But he thought he'd like to be part of it. And we all agreed with him. I remember Lieutenant Jors looking down at the table, shaking his head and let us go. And so that's what happened.
Joe,
but anyway, that framework of giving that technology and experience was really important, although I never wanted to be an engineer and I never wanted to, and I was the idea of being a pre-med now, I knew I would not be very, I wouldn't have a good chance of entering medical school because my enthusiasm just wasn't there.
You know,
and I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I talk too much, don't I?
Well, no. It's a fascinating story. The problem is you've got so much. It's fascinating. It's interesting. We've got only a couple of minutes left here. And all of this, Joe's story is in his book, A Teacher's Tale. You'll find the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the usual places. A Teacher's Tale, a memoir. Joe Gilliland, and that's G-I-L-L-I-L-A-N-D. Joe, I'm going to take the final couple minutes here of this program, and hopefully we can do this again. But you mentioned Japan, and that really shaped you, didn't it? I met your wife there. That not only shaped your life, but so many young students in Japan who to this day remember with great fondness your teaching abilities and how you really brought them alive from an academic standpoint.
Well, that was another matter of luck. I had really wanted, part of my service, the last year of my service, had been in Korea. And although a lot of people hated Korea, I found that a most exciting place because it was so backward in terms of what we had in this country. And the reason it was because of the Japanese occupation of Korea had been extremely oppressive. And I wanted to go back to Korea. And I found out that the Methodist Church was hiring people to go for what they call short-term missionaries to teach English or anything possible. And I signed up. And the day I began studying Korean language and a course called Teaching English as a Second Language, the war started in Korea. And so I was told that they're going to shut down all the people going to Korea. And I had a choice of either resigning from the program or taking a position in Japan. In case the war stopped early, I might be still able to go to Korea. Well, I was sent to a place called Wakayama and Wakayama University. And of the two young people that were in the short-term missionary program, I was one of two that was assigned to a university and assigned to a national university and not a mission school. And so Wakayama University was a brand new four-year institution that specialized in economics and teaching and agriculture. That was their specialties. And so I was teaching English as a second language,
yes,
as they call it, conversational. And I have students today that I correspond with ever since I first met them there in 1950.
You know, it's amazing that you've had that rapport with the students. You opened up a new world for them with you, your personality, your unique teaching style. And as you were talking about all these different teachers, it's almost like you learned a little something along the way. Each teacher, the good and the bad, that molded you into the amazing teacher that you became. Boy, the time has gone by so quickly. I said in the beginning, it's like making a new friend. Talking with Joe is like making a new friend, and you'll feel that way when you read Joe's book, A Teacher's Tale, a Memoir. Joe Gilliland, and I'll break that down, that's G-I-L-L-I-L-A-N-D. If you Google A Teacher's Tale, a Memoir, you'll find that book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the usual places. Go to our website, thisweekinamerica.us, and link directly on to Joe's book. Joe, this has been a real pleasure. Just touch the surface of those early years and the impact you had on so many people worldwide, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. Hopefully we can do this again. Thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you for having me. I'd love to talk about this stuff. Thank you very much.
And I love to listen to you talk about it. It really has gone by way too quickly. Joe Gilliland is our guest on the program, G-I-L-L-I-L-A-N-D. The book, A Teacher's Tale, a Memoir. You'll find it at Amazon, the usual places. And, of course, information online at thisweekinamerica.us. We're back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.